The stupid fires came again this year, burned the golden state of California to a crisp. Thankfully, the rain came to put out the fires, but also to provide more fuel for next year's stupid fires. And so we ask, can we turn stupid fire into smart fire?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,172nd edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Lima who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, I had an occasion to spend some time down in the Amazon a few years ago. One of the things I found to be truly amazing about the Amazon was its soil. You see, though the Amazon holds so much greenery, it is often called the lungs of the earth, its soil holds no nutrients. It's almost inert, like glass. Most all of the give and take of life in the Amazon takes place on the surface of the soil. You can see it before your very eyes. A leaf falls from a tree. The moment it hits the ground, it is disassembled by a myriad of hungry organisms and taken right back up into the forest. Fact is, death does not last very long in the Amazon. For that reason, it was long thought that the Amazon soil could not support a population of people who lived by agriculture, even though the first Europeans to explore the Amazon basin claimed to have found vast populations of people living in cities supported by agriculture. But those populations were gone by the time the second Europeans went looking. All that remained were hunters and gatherers. Not too long ago, scientists flying over the Amazon saw patterns below that indicated civilization. When they went down for a look, they found that civilizations did indeed exist in the Amazon, and they did so with an agriculture based on a black soil, which they called, in Portuguese, Terra Preta de Indio, or Black Earth of the Indian. And that, my friends, is what is truly amazing about the Amazon. People tend to call, we tend to call them primitive, but they turn that inert soil of the Amazon basin into life-holding civilization, and they did it with Terra Preta. And they built that Terra Preta with smart fire. Now, if we were to compare the destructive fires of our civilized forest with the constructive fires of that primitive Amazon forest, we would probably find ourselves asking, can we turn stupid fire into smart fire? And that's what we're going to consider today. Here to help us lead the conversation, we have forester and biochar advocate Jenna Bennett from Olympia, Washington. Jenna, welcome aboard.
Thank you. I'm really glad you're focusing on this today.
Well, you know, you're the responsible party for this because I did a show in two editions of the Food Chain ago. And we talked about turning wood scraps in the forest into pellets that could be burned much more efficiently in our wood stoves, make heat, cook food, even generate electricity, could do it so much smarter than we're doing it today. And you communicated with me and said, what about biochar?
Yeah.
And so here we are. You also suggested including Gary Klein. And so here's Gary Klein with us. Gary, welcome to the Food Chain.
Yeah, I'm glad to be a part of it.
And you are you're also up there in Olympic Peninsula, right?
Well, I'm near Olympia, which is on the southern end of the peninsula, you might say.
Mm-hmm. I once had an occasion to get snowed in on the Olympic Peninsula, and it was a very romantic time.
Yeah.
There you were. You weren't going anywhere, so you just enjoyed it, and it was absolutely beautiful. Gary, could you give us a thumbnail on what the difference is between the forests of the Olympic Peninsula and that of the Amazon?
Well, they're both rainforests. They get a lot of rain. which translates into high leaching of soil minerals. I'm sure there are differences because this is obviously in the north, in the temperate climate, and the Amazon is in the tropics. There's certainly a different kind of vegetation, but overall, you know, it's rainforest in both cases. Don't know what more to say on that.
Well, that's kind of exactly what I was thinking. They are rainforests, and the soils tend to leach, right?
Yes.
There you go. Now, let's talk a little bit about the terms we're going to be working with today. And the first one is biochar. And Jenna, you being the one that introduced the subject, what the heck is biochar?
Well, biochar is carbon in a state after pyrolysis, which is heating carbon. I came into understanding it through Gary, but because we deal with a lot of dead trees, we had wood waste to experiment with. So in a controlled environment, creating a steel vessel to control the burn and make biochar is a temperature between 400 and 800 that we've measured. And what happens is it's heating wood to a point and not allowing the oxygen, and depleting the wood of oxygen creates biochar, if I explain that.
How'd you do, Gary?
Well, I would add that biochar is essentially charcoal made in nature or by humans for the purpose of making charcoal, and it becomes biochar when it goes into the soil and gets populated by biological organisms. So you get the bio and the char. Mm-hmm. And it's made by controlled burning, in which the object is to eliminate oxygen supply to the fire, and that is what we know as pyrolysis, and results in the charcoal, which is nearly pure carbon, provided you stop the fire at the right point.
Ah, kind of like being a chef.
Yes, yeah, you let it go too long, and then it simply becomes ashes, and you haven't gained anything. And once you make the biochar, then you spread it on the land. Ideally, you inoculate it or charge it with some mineral material so that it starts out fully charged and doesn't draw those things out of, say, your garden for a while.
Mm-hmm. Now, I started off the program talking about, you know, the difference between smart fire and stupid fire. Mm-hmm. It seems like the fires we had here in California this summer were really stupid fires. Because they made a tremendous amount of smoke, and they just laid waste to the terrain. Yeah. Am I wrong?
No positive return.
However, these fires were started by humans, and so that adds to the causes that might normally occur occasionally because of lightning strikes. And it can be argued that that's all part of nature, and that almost all forests at one time or another do burn, and then they come back. You could argue that, that's for another later time.
Okay.
I wanted to make.
Okay. But go ahead, Jenna.
I would also like to add that over the practices in the woods of not removing, not selectively harvesting, just like I heard in the past, thinning your carrots, we haven't had healthy woods, and there was just so much dead, dying, like a ladder effect, creating huge, uncontrollable fires, and it gave no return. So there was no thought towards it, and the end result is it's just a lot of pollution and destruction.
And, you know, being downwind of those fires was truly gruesome stuff, because what was burning in those fires wasn't just wood. It seemed like everything was burning in those fires. And I think about, you know, going back to those primitive Indians in the headwaters in the Amazon basin and how they were somehow clever enough to burn wood smartly and then turn it into charcoal, and then to use that charcoal to build black earth or terra preta, and from that black earth sustain civilizations. It seems like there really is a possibility of doing things smartly instead of stupidly, and that's the subject of today's Food Chain Radio program. When I come back, I'm going to pick up the question of, is it possible to use fire to rebuild soil? Do stay tuned.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Can't think of anything I enjoy more than tending a fire out there in the woods. What could be more peaceful than stoking the fire and keeping it going and burning it down to ash? And in watching the movie that Jenna suggested I watch last night, there was what was the name of that movie, Jenna?
Well, I've sent you the documentary on the Mindful Burn.
Yeah, the Mindful Burn, yes.
It was the demonstration here in Adna, Washington in early November.
Mm-hmm. So people can find that by searching for the Mindful Burn, right?
Yeah, it's okay. Adam Abraham's YouTube, and that is a flame cap kiln.
Right. Now, Gary was also part of that video, and so
yeah,
we got to meet him that way. But what amazed me about the Mindful Burn, in which you demonstrate the production of biochar, was the fact that it reminded me of every time I've been around a campfire with other people, everybody just gets involved in the fire. And
yeah,
and one of the things, of course, everybody gets involved with is dodging the smoke, as it were. But that's all part of making the biochar. So I'd like to learn from the both of you how one goes about making biological charcoal. Of course, you first have to start with a charcoal and before you can make it a biochar. So how does one go about making biochar? Jenna, let's start with you.
Well, in my experience, first and foremost is the most efficient form of fuel is dried and cured. So the documentary you see, there was some wet green wood which creates smoke. And that's where our regulations with the EPA and air quality, they're,
Oh, so we're going to have a war here with making biochar, aren't we? Because the EPA is going to say you're making too much smoke.
Exactly. And up here in Olympia, I tried to get our fire department to host a demonstration burn for our neighborhood to encourage people to reduce burn loads, because we're semi-rural. There are no fire hydrants out here. So reducing burn load of all of this dry, dead material and create something useful out of it. I wanted to make a day-long workshop. Well, ultimately, fire department had to check in with air quality, and all the regulations. It's a new frontier.
Sure.
For carving out regulations around burns. And we couldn't put it on because they were regulated to only burning the brush on that property. So it didn't happen. But exploring new terrain in that way, like specifically, like an interesting side note is that there's a 100,000-acre tree farm out here that is inviting Lands Commission out to demonstrate a slash pile burn.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the fuel's got to be dry, and we don't have to start with coals. It's starting a small fire, and you just add wood. And what happens is the flame is what sucks the oxygen away from the burning material, and that's what depletes the oxygen of your wood,
sure,
leaving charcoal behind. So you work with it. You are communicating with the fire.
Well, it seems, Gary, like the federal government, I'm certain, is looking at burning anything these days as being part of what we've always done, which is kind of stupid fire, if you think about it, and that we're going to make a mess of the atmosphere. So it seems like we're going to be in a confrontation with the federal government as we go about making biochar. Is that true?
Yeah, I think we could work at some kind of, compromise, some sort of understanding that this is smart way to make charcoal and to burn. And once we can convince local and regional and federal agencies of that, then maybe we get some dispensation for making a product that is extremely valuable as opposed to something that becomes simple waste. And in fact, in my view, the making and distribution of biochar onto agricultural and forest lands and so forth is about the most important thing we can do. It will bring down atmospheric CO2 by not allowing more of it to go into the air. And to my thinking, this is what's going to save us, this and mineralizing the soils. So when you have a forest fire, a small percentage of the wood becomes charcoal. But when we do it this way, in a controlled and regulated way, we produce a pretty high percentage. About a third of what we burn winds up being nearly pure charcoal, which is a truly amazing substance.
So essentially then, instead of throwing all that carbon back up into the air,
yes,
as we did with the fires here in California, we're taking a good third of it and putting it back into the earth.
Well, the other two-thirds is going to go into the atmosphere, but pretty much harmlessly, and there's no getting around that when you burn.
Right.
Most of the fuel goes up into the air as either smoke or I'm trying to think. Carbon dioxide is some of it, but a lot of the in the biochar making, a lot of it goes into pretty much pure charcoal.
And that pure charcoal is pure gold when you put it into the earth.
It truly is. I think it's what's going to save us. That and doing the mineralization is going to save society in the long run, and can bring down the atmospheric CO2, that is, reduce global warming. And whether or not you think that's real, what's the harm in doing that? And the bonus is we use it to greatly improve agriculture, and if we use it enough of it, along with the mineralization, we've basically set us up in terms of food supply for the next 1,000 years. We don't have to do hardly anything else to the soil because the biochar retains the minerals, which are the foundation of productivity and fertility and leading to high quality food.
And when we
and humus.
And humus. We're going to pick up exactly how all of this works in the soil after we get back from the next break. But backing up a little, and of course, the interesting thing about biochar or terra preta in the Amazon is that people are now mining it and taking it into the cities,
yes,
and selling it for fertilizer. And folks, this is soil that's centuries and centuries and centuries old,
yes,
and it's vital. It still holds life.
It has not lost its fertility, and furthermore, you scrape it off and come back a few years later, and there's just as much as when you started.
It's magic.
It's magic. It grows like coral reef.
Wow. And there it is. And it was made by the very primitive Indians in the Amazon Basin.
Right. We don't respect enough or give the primitives credit for their wisdom. They knew an awful lot. And they were able to, as you say, discover how to use this charcoal in their soil in a way that captured the minerals that were ordinarily being lost through leaching out and disappearing into the subsoil or beyond. So that was the secret to how they developed a civilization where instead of being able to get about 3 years of vegetable production off of a plot of land, they could get 300 or 3,000 years.
And we call them primitive.
and the problem was they didn't have resistance to European diseases.
And that's what happened.
When Europeans showed up, those diseases spread into their population and killed about 95% of the population off.
We're going to have to take a quick break. Folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back with Terra, Preta, Bio, Char, and you, right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Always fascinated with the notion of F.H. King's book, Farmers of 40 Centuries, because he talks about the farmers of China being able to survive for 40 centuries. And they did it with what they had. They didn't bring in fertilizers from the outside world or much of anything from the outside world. They had to take what they had there, where they lived and where they farmed. And they had to use that to continue growing crops that sustained them for 4,000 years. It's an amazing process. And if you think about it, kind of the same thing happened down there in the Amazon, where people, the ancient civilizations, the primitive people, figured out how to inoculate the sterile soil of the Amazon with charcoal that they manufactured by burning smartly instead of stupidly the wood, and then turning that wood into charcoal, and they put it into the soil. And then what happens? Gary, what happens when we put charcoal into the soil?
Well, charcoal is able to capture nutrients, and because it's a catacomb construction of charcoal.
What does that mean?
Well, there's thousands of tiny pores in the structure of the charcoal, and this houses organisms and protects them, but it also soaks up what are known as cations and anions, which are minerals that plant life requires, and animal life too. So that doesn't get lost when it rains. The charcoal is able to hang on to it through an electrical charge, or actually both electrical charges, pluses and minuses, so that the minerals are captured or adsorbed onto the charcoal tightly enough that it resists being washed away.
So there it is.
Yes.
Go ahead, Jenna.
I'd love to add in the quality of purification in the soils and in water. And back to the Terra Preta, that was a way that they purified their sanitation. They were pretty smart to know that carbon does that by its nature. It's like two carbon molecules to oxygen, and however that happens, it's a purifier, just like we take activated charcoal internally for issues of taking in poisons. It's a purifier as well. It does it all.
Gary?
Well, that's true, and the more complex toxicants and pollutants and so forth are also captured by the biochar, or the carbon, in a way that they are more powerfully held because there's a lot more charge and attraction there. So they are held out of the system, who knows for how long, and that purifies or detoxifies the ingredients that go into it. So we know that in different spots around the earth a few hundred years ago, biochar was known. Of course, they didn't know that there was such a thing as carbon, but they knew that this biochar did amazing things for the soils, and I'm not sure that the Chinese were aware of this or used it in their regenerative agriculture.
You know, I did not see any, I have not seen any reference to biochar in my, you know, wandering through the literature.
Right. Up until about, year 2000 or 2005, it was known by a few people, a few scientists, but it really started breaking through right about that time. And about 2010 or 12, the information started getting around, and it was being investigated a lot, and people were...
Wasn't that about the time they discovered the patterns in the Amazon basin that indicated civilization, and they went down and looked, and they found it's terra preta?
Yeah, it was. Yeah. So it was evidence. They saw all these fields from the air that had to have been man-made. They had dikes around them, and there were canals and so forth. And so it was evidence of an advanced civilization, an agricultural civilization that numbered in the millions, and otherwise would not have been possible except for the biochar hanging on to the nutrients.
Amazing. And here we're trying to make it in the Pacific Northwest, in the rainforests of the Olympic Peninsula.
Right.
And what we did is we took a big, huge iron bucket, and we put a bunch of wood in there, and we burned it down. But we did it smartly.
Yeah.
And that's right. the smart thing being what, Gary?
Well, there are subtleties to making the biochar. When you put it in what we call a trough, that focuses the heat inward, and you just build a fire in there, and you keep it going. The flames on the top burn up the oxygen so that it can't get to the cold underneath.
There's the smart part, then.
And at some point, you have to put this out, or it'll burn all the way down to ash and be useless. So you can do that by drowning it, or you could do it by putting on some sort of a smothering blanket and stopping it at just the right stage, and then you shovel it out and maybe break it up, and then you apply it to the soil, either on the top or ideally...
Work it in.
Soil a ways, along with the mineralization. I want to keep emphasizing that. That's what upgrades the soil.
Mineralization meaning what?
Well, there's 92 known elements in the natural elements in the universe, and about a third of those we know are needed by plants, and a lot of them tend to get lost over time. If they are ordinarily there, but they tend to get lost over time, and we have to replace them, and particularly if we're doing agriculture and growing things and taking away the food or the animals or whatever. So whenever that leaves, it takes with it the minerals, and you have to replace them.
Are we replacing minerals in our industrial agriculture?
Only partially, and that's the problem. If you don't replace them all in the correct balance and don't have them in the soil in the correct balance, things don't work right, and you don't wind up with nutritious food. If you try putting on a couple of them, say potassium and phosphorus, which are part of what we call the NPK mentality, the simplistic thinking and the simplistic fertilization, the plants take those up, and maybe even in excess as you go over time, continuing to add this, the certain nutrients get taken up in excess, and the other minerals, trace minerals and so on, they also get taken up, but they don't get replaced. And so
now we're in trouble, but that leads
us... Then the food becomes inferior, and when we eat that, our health becomes inferior, and we wind up...
In trouble. Folks, we have to take a quick break. Right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we do get in trouble too, don't we, by not putting all of those minerals back into the soil. Jenna, you had a comment? Fire away.
I did. I had read in the Carbon Connection that 1 pound of excess nitrogen eats up 100 pounds of humus because the microbes have to work that much harder to process those salts.
Mm-hmm. So and what do we put in our soil? NPK, right?
Exactly. So if you're thinking over the past 100 years, the hundreds and thousands of pounds of humus that have been dissolved, which is carbon, part of it's carbon, we've lost carbon, and that has gone up in the atmosphere, gasified somewhere else, not where it should be, with the microbes that fed energy, you know, the energy exchange, the whole energy system. Mm-hmm. I feel,
you know, people don't realize it, or I didn't realize it either until I really started thinking about it, that those organisms down there are buying and selling just like we are up here in the supermarket, right?
Right.
Gary?
I'm not sure I follow you, but...
Well, they buy and sell nutrients in the soil, kind of like we do in the grocery store by exchanging mineral ions, this for that.
Mm-hmm.
I just think that a healthy soil contains all of those things that plants need. We don't know what the heck they are, but we pretend we do. We think all they need is NPK, but they probably need a lot more than that.
Well, for certain, we know that there are at least 18 minerals that plants need to have to grow really healthy. So we're trying to feed them two. Nitrogen, I don't think of as a mineral. We're feeding them two when they ought to have 18.
There you go. Now, what happens then? Describe the process, what happens when we put the carbon into the soil, and we have that reaction between the biological organisms. What is it about the carbon that they like?
Well, it's not the carbon itself. It's what the carbon does, enables. As I said, it captures minerals, but also other nutrients. And the microbes themselves have to have that, and they participate in developing more complex compounds, vitamins, for instance. They can make them. They make more than they need. And they go about excreting these minerals and other nutrients into the soil, which plants can take up, or they process exudates, what they call exudates, that are given up by the plant roots. The plant gives it up to the microbes.
That's the buying and selling I was talking about.
Yeah, that's right. So they build more complex molecules and give them back to the plant. So there is a mutualism there.
Now,
and I
go ahead, Jenna.
Oh, I was going to add, I have the visual example of transplanting little starts that I have biochar in, and as I pull up the plant, the little roots are just grabbing onto this little piece of charcoal, like that's the source. It's growing from whatever's in there.
Whatever's hiding in that charcoal is what the plants are looking for. Gary, you're the proprietor of Blossom Consulting Services. You help people with their soil. What happens when you transition from plain old leached out soil to a soil rich in biochar?
Well, again, the biochar is not itself the nutrient. You know, all of life is made out of carbon as the backbone or the foundation. There is no life without carbon. And biochar is a form of carbon, but also diamonds are a form of carbon. So it exists in different forms, and in charcoal, that's not really available to the microorganisms or to the plants. So again, it's just a carrier, a vehicle for carrying the nutrients and enabling the microbes to expand and earthworms and so forth. And it does so in a fairly magical way so that it actually kind of grows. As I said, if you take it away and leave it a while, it will turn more of the existing soil into terra preta-like soil.
Which is what the primitive Indians of the Amazon basin discovered.
Yes, they no doubt found this out by accident and observation and said, well, let's try it again, and found out that it works, and then it spread and spread and spread. There were many thousands of acres of lands that were converted, presumably from rainforest into agricultural fields in certain parts of the Amazon basin and extending into Bolivia.
And what's really amazing, I guess, to me, is that we see this evidence in the Amazon basin. Mm-hmm. We see how it supported a civilization of millions of people for, who knows, thousands of years.
Yes.
And we look at it and kind of scratch our heads, and we have to ask, can we, you know, turn our stupid burning into smart burning?
Right.
That will somehow enable us to survive for thousands of years. You know, we look at those farmers of 40 centuries in China with no outside inputs, and you look at what we're doing, dumping 300 million pounds of weed killer on our heads every year.
Yes.
Is that going to allow us to survive for 40 centuries? I'm thinking not. So when we come back, I'm going to ask you a really big, tough question.
Right.
Which is, can we use smart burning to turn our deserts into forests? Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, so much to talk about and so little time to talk about it in with forester and biochar advocate Jenna Bennett from up there in Olympia, Washington. Also, the nutriculturalist, he calls himself, Gary Klein, Blossom Consulting Services. What the heck is a nutriculturalist, Gary?
Well, that's a new term that I coined for where we need to go in the future. This is a large step above ordinary organics or certified organics, because the focus is on the nutrition that you have to wind up with in order to improve our health. And so nutriculture comes from nutrient, and the object of that agronomic system, which also incorporates use of biochar, is to get maximum or very high nutrient density into the food, without which we are never going to be healthy. So we spoke earlier about we're in trouble. In the past century or so, various degenerative diseases, heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and so forth, have skyrocketed from the time when before industrialization were fairly low in the population. And so what's the cause? I think a major part of it, besides pollutants, has to do with the loss of nutrients in our food.
Well, hard to argue with that, I guess. I guess you could, but you look around and you see everything kind of degenerating, and it must be coming from something. So I just have to ask my question here. Do you think fire can be used to turn deserts into forests and savannas?
Well, of course, the desert itself isn't going to burn,
particularly
if it's mostly sand. But we can make biochar by, in my proposal, is cleaning up most of the woody debris that falls in the forest.
And makes for stupid fires, right?
Yeah, pardon?
And all that stuff that makes for stupid fires.
Right. So it has to, in order to make biochar, it has to be dry, and it needs to be of a certain size. You can't obviously burn a whole tree in a container. But cleaning up a lot of that, which is the major cause of rampant wildfires. So if we remove that and turn it into biochar and then simply return it right back to the ground or sell it to farmers or whatever, we can do a lot to reduce stupid fires and create this material, which is biochar. It would be the basis for anything we're trying to do in converting desert lands and particularly degraded lands, and yeah. It's been done.
I would like to just use the word stewardship, because people, what would need to be activated is people rolling up their sleeves and getting out there to steward the land.
Oh, Jenna, you just hit it right on the head there. It's
uh-oh.
About people.
Yeah.
It was about those Indians in the Amazon. It was about the farmers in China. And we're out of time, but gosh, you two were too much fun. Think about it, ladies and gentlemen. Smart fire instead of stupid fire. Thanks to Jenna, thanks to Gary, and thanks you all for tuning in. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio on the Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.